Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. I think you should be able to hear okay. If you can't, we have a handheld microphone. George has made it, which is great. So we put this on late in the year because Trivial Pursuit was out. And so I'll introduce George Megalogenis to you very briefly. He spoke here early in the year when we did our wrap-up of the political situation. But George Megalogenis is a senior writer with The Australian and author of Fault Lines, Race Work and the Politics of Change in Australia, and, of course, The Longest Decade, which was in the first edition, then a revised edition. And most recently, the author of Quarterly Essay, issue number 40, Trivial Pursuit, Leadership and the End of the Reform Agenda. And, of course, George appears most days in The Australian and, of course, is also a commentator on the Insiders program. And he's very welcome here to talk today on the topic of election 2010 and beyond. George Megalogenis, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared and Anne. I have to raise this.
Sure.
I'm up. Microphone in Sydney, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I'm just wondering about it. Hang on, let's do this.
I thought it was yours.
No, it's not. There's a laptop here.
Oh, I thought that was your laptop. And you're all set up to do some sort of very impressive work. So, yeah. If anyone wants a laptop, we'll auction it for sort of the Sydney Institute Christmas fund. Conclusion.
What do you reckon? Is that good enough? No, not on that. I've still got to look down to the...
We'll edit all that out of the podcast. So off you go.
I thought we were going live. Jared and Anne, thank you. I know it's late in the year, so there's a bit of Christmas spirit around. So this is going to be a fairly chatty presentation, and I'm going to give you all a good 20 to 30 minutes opportunity for questions and answers. And I'm going to begin by having a good look at the Victorian election, which a lot of lessons, I think, are about to be learnt, which we can apply to the national scene. And, of course, before the next federal election, there's the New South Wales state election, where some of the lessons of the Victorian election might come in handy. Now, what you're looking at between the federal election in August in Victoria and the state election the other week, a tale of two primary votes. 8 percentage points of the Labor and Green combined votes shifted. How are we going?
All right.
It's not on?
I just think it needs to be a little bit more like that. It's directional, so...
Okay.
If we just get it near you... Is that better?
Okay,
there? So you don't have to lean
test,
over.
Test, like that.
There you go. That should be fine. If you just... If you're above it and near
okay.
it.
Every now and then I'll be looking down, of course, to check the odd number. Now, just starting again, the difference between the Victorian state election result the other week and how Victorians voted at the federal election in August, there's an 8 percentage point difference in the primary vote. Labor lost 6.5% from its federal vote to its state vote, and that pretty much transferred across to the Liberal Party. The Greens lost another 1.5%. That's quite a big shift. You don't normally see that between state and federal elections. There is, you know, margin of about 2 to 3 percentage points that you will get some differentiation between. And we're going to leave to one side the fact that Labor were a long-term government. I think one of the big transactions in the state election that we've just had is that the Liberal Party decided to ignore Labor's problem with its base. It put the Greens last, and it sent a message in the second last week of the campaign to not just traditional Liberal voters, but disengaged voters and swinging voters, that the Liberals were serious about earning power in their own right. Now, this wasn't the reason why Tony Abbott had a poor showing in Victoria at the federal election. There are a number of reasons for that. But the game that the Federal Liberal Party played at the last federal election was an insider's game. It was a preference game. It was a poke Labor in the eye. It really wasn't about standing up to the people of Australia and say, this is what an alternate government will look like, and we have the confidence we have the courage of our convictions to be able to stand alone and not care what happens to the Labor base vote. Now, the reason why the Victorian thing worked was in the last couple of days, people were looking to change government, but as we saw in New South Wales in 2007 and in Queensland in 2009, it doesn't necessarily happen if the other side isn't presenting a confident alternative. Now, in that, as I said, in that last couple of weeks, the Liberal Party declared that it had the courage of its convictions to be able to put the Greens last and not care what happened to the Labor Party in the inner city. And they picked up huge swings in seats that neither side anticipated, and particularly in the suburbs. Now, a couple of the big transactions were across what we call the Frankston Line, which is that southeast corridor, and also the Mount Waverley Line into the eastern suburbs. Labor lost every seat along those two train lines. They'd held a few. The Liberals had held a few closer to town, but Labor now holds no seats across those two train lines, which tells you that public transport was the number one vote-switching concern at that election. But public transport merges with a cost-of-living concern, and the Liberal Party came up with something in the last couple of weeks, which was a concession for pensioners to extend the concession on energy, on electricity charges and gas charges, and that thing apparently also did some vote-switching as well. Now, through the course of this year, as I'll talk to you as a Melburnian now, well, I've been having some very Sydney experiences in Melbourne the last couple of years. The place is not that easy to get around in. But one of the reasons why Melbourne is suffering is a bit of a problem with infrastructure, its physical infrastructure and also its health and education, is that it's a very popular state and a very popular city. The population growth in the last 5 years in Victoria, each budget, there's always a correction for the number of people they missed the previous year. Have always underestimated population, have underestimated fertility, so you have normal problems of a boom where they haven't made enough allowance for roads, haven't made enough allowance for schools, even maternity beds. Now, small problem in Victoria. Now, if you have people having babies, where do you put them? Now, a lot of people are actually delivering babies in five-star hotels in the city. It's one way to deal with that immediate shortage. Now, the Liberal Party were aware of this and came at the Brumby government, I wouldn't call it from the left, but came at them from a service delivery perspective, and were offering to problem solve. And at a state level, that thing tends to resonate. And I think if you look around you here, if you're looking for a reason to change government, this is not a party political commentary, but the reason for change government is to fix this city and to fix this state. Now, the Liberal Party had the sense to pitch a positive agenda. There weren't that many policies, but they did pitch a positive agenda, and as I say, didn't get caught up in the argument about where they put the Greens. Thing to bear in mind, though, about the Greens didn't have a good state election because they've lost the balance of power in the upper house because the coalition on the final count have got the balance of power in their own right in Victoria, notwithstanding the fact that in the lower house they've only got a one-seat majority. It's a pretty unusual election result. But we'll leave that to one side. The Greens actually didn't do too badly. Victoria is now the first state in this cycle where the Greens at a state election level have had better than 10% at consecutive state elections in the lower house. Now, there's no precedent for that across third-party outbreaks over the last 20 or 30 years. Now, the Democrats did do well traditionally in South Australia, but that was pretty much home base for that party once, not in the Dom Chip years, but in the Janine Haines and then in Natasha Stott Despoja. But what the Greens did in Victoria, notwithstanding their failure at the seat level, was still pull a pretty healthy vote. So they are in a position now where they've got 10% plus guaranteed to them. The Labor Party in Victoria know that that's their voter. The Labor Party have a much bigger problem, not just in Victoria, but nationally. Their primary vote now, and this is a situation that began in 1990 when Bob Hawke won that federal election with less than 40% of the primary vote and relied on the Democrat preferences. Since 1990, the Labor Party have only had two decent federal election results above 40%. And that was Paul Keating's victory over John Hewson in 93, and Kevin Rudd's victory in 2007. I'll go into the numbers in a minute, and there's some figures that have probably surprised me, I must admit, when I had a good look through Labor's record. Now, I want to talk a bit more about the Green vote and what's been motivating it. There is certainly a protest to the left flank of the Labor Party. But the other thing to bear in mind about the Green vote is in our system we've never had a third party to the left of the Labor Party. Previous outbreaks, whether it was One Nation or the Australian Democrats, Democrats, remember, began as on the left flank of the Malcolm Fraser Liberal Party. One Nation, of course, right flank of John Howard's Liberal Party. The Greens are, in our system, the first pro-reform protest movement that can pull 10% primary vote across the country. Now, this is part of the theme, of course, of the essay that I think the reform era in Australia has been dead for a number of years. And the Green vote is a manifestation of that. There is a good deal of the population now that's picked in both major parties a loss of belief, and they're dumping their primary vote with the Greens as a I don't care protest or to send a message to the major parties. Now, it's Labor's problem at the moment, but you need to bear in mind that it began as the Liberal Party's problem. When John Howard was in government, the Greens began as a breakout to the left of the Liberal Party, and they began with professional women in their 20s and 30s who started to move off the Liberal pile at the 2001 and especially the 2004 elections. Now, the majority for them was doctors' wives. There's something a bit more substantial. When we come to the 2010 election, we break down the Tony Abbott's vote. There's now a loss on the Liberal side from where their traditional numbers were for women aged in their 20s and 30s of roughly 10 percentage points. Now, I'm comparing the 2001 and 2004 elections with the 2010 election result. I've also got some pretty good news poll data that tells me that the Liberal Party long-term are tracking 10% lower primary vote amongst young women than they were a decade ago. Labor has a similar problem. Labor's problem's bigger amongst younger voters with men than it is with women. So at the last federal election, the Green primary vote amongst men aged under 35 was 25%. For women under 35, it was 20%. Now, that's a Julia effect. Gillard had slightly stronger vote, primary vote for Labor amongst young women than she did for young men. Now, think this thing through. If we're talking about a pro-reform protest movement, nothing like what the Democrats were pulling in 1990, which was at the edge of the recession, nothing like what the One Nation was pulling in 98, which is the aftermath of recession, and there was a big restructuring issue, still flowing through the national economy. The Greens are very popular. The younger the voter, the closer you get to the CBD, with people who have never known recession, who want the main parties to stand for something. And that's why I look at the voter and am more interested in the voter than I am in the party itself. The party itself, if it had any survival instinct, would let go its old agenda and ask young people what they want from a mainstream party or from a third party, and pretty much hand their organisation over to Gen Y. Because somewhere in Gen Y, there is what the next wave, whether it's the next big reform idea or whether it's the next consensus, exists. Now, I'm not sure that institutionally the Greens are capable of this, because the Greens are looking at their vote and they're assuming it's about the values of the party organisation. It has, trust me, it has nothing to do with the standard Green agenda. This is an active, urban, and a professional and a young protest vote against both main parties. Now, it's because Labor's in power that it's manifested itself as a collapse in the Labor primary vote. And we know the trigger when we look at the federal scene is when Kevin Rudd walked away from the ETS. Labor were on course, a comfortable victory with a reduced majority, until he walked away from the greatest moral challenge of our time. Now, the coalition primary vote did not move in the first 3 or 4 months until Rudd walked away from the ETS. Then Liberal voters that were probably prepared to give Labor a go on climate change had no reason to vote Labor. They went home to the Liberal Party. Traditional Labor voters went straight over to the Greens. The Greens vote essentially doubled between elections. It came back a bit just before polling day, but essentially, as you look through the last term, their votes picked has doubled across the country, but especially driven by this younger vote. Now, this younger vote was the thing that threw John Howard out of power in 2007. Remember, Kevin Rudd was riding this youth wave in 2007. And in the first couple of polls for Julia Gillard, that vote was holding up for her. That vote's gone now for the Labor Party. And some of these voters have voted for the first time and haven't voted for a main party. The question I ask both sides of politics, and I've never had an answer that satisfies me yet. If someone in the 20s and 30s doesn't think Labor or Liberal, what's to make them vote for a main party in their 40s and 50s? I think there's a big demographic issue for both sides of politics when we look at the breakdown of those votes. Now, how can you demonstrate this? Well, something very interesting has been happening since 1990. In the federal sphere, we've had 8 elections since 1990. In 5 of those 8 elections, Labor hasn't even got a 40% primary. In every election, except one, which is 93, the main parties have not even got close to 90% combined primary vote. Now, over the course of the 90s and the last decade, between 15 and 20% of all Australians are voting none of the above. The surprise to me is it took so long to get a hung parliament. Now, what none of the above means in our system, well, what it means in our system is that the Labor Party never knew a vote below 40%. It used to be a catastrophe if it was at 41 or 42. Now, I'll walk you through some historical data here. Between 1910 and 1987, with 32 federal elections, and only 2 occasions in those 32 federal elections did the Labor Party primary vote go below 40%. 31, Great Depression, 37.67. So James Scullin has blown up a party for a decade because they couldn't handle the Depression. He wasn't the only one who had that problem around the world, but for the Labor Party, that was the end of the world. Now, I've counted back Lang Labor into the Labor primary to pretty much get a like-for-like comparison. Otherwise, you have to take 2 elections out. The only other one below 40% was 1977, 39.65. That was the first election the Democrats stood. So both Fraser and Whitlam lost primary vote. Now, remember when Gough was thrashed in 75, Labor had a primary vote of 42.84%, and in those days that was considered a catastrophe. Why was that considered a catastrophe? Each time Labor took office, beginning with Scullin in 29, looking at the Curtin victory in his own right in 43, looking at Gough in 72, and even looking at Hawke in 83, when a Labor Party took power, it took power of a primary vote of around 49%. I won't give you the exact numbers, but there's only a fraction either way. 49 is quite a big number. It'd be unusual in our system today for either of the main parties to get 49. But this used to be routine for the Labor Party. This was how they'd win power. Roughly half the population would put one for them. They'd never win big, of course, but you were sure, when you got a Labor government, that you had half the population thinking that this is what they wanted. Kevin Rudd's 2007 election result, and I've had a really good look at this after the fact, and I'm kicking myself as a journalist that I missed it at the time, but you've got to admit, sometimes you're too busy distracted by the fall of a government than you are to appreciate what the new government brings to the table. Labor's primary vote in 2007, mind you, this is a landslide by Labor terms after preferences, but they only had 43.88%. Kevin Rudd won 6 percentage points somewhere else. As I said, traditionally Labor would come to power all the way through to the Hawke era with a primary vote of around 49, they're down to 43.88. Of course, they've just been re-elected as a minority government with a primary vote of under 38%. The one that they've just had is the third lowest on record, and it's not that far off the 31 worst ever. Now, remember the stat I gave you? Between 1910 and 1987, on only 2 occasions in 32 federal elections, Labor had a primary vote below 40%. Since 1990, we've had 8 elections, 5 times. So, they're in trouble. Now, I showed Julia Gillard this graph, actually. I can't show it to you because it's too small. And we didn't have an on-the-record conversation about it, and I'm not about to disclose the off-the-record conversation. But I checked it with a couple of people after the fact, and they say that this is the same problem the British Labour Party have got, and it's the same problem the Democrats have in the US. Parties to the centre-left, since the end of the Cold War, and since the centre-left parties embraced some free market principles, and since deregulation and the end of that sort of blue-collar economy that we had, has splintered what was traditionally, between 40 and 50% share of the population that would always vote centre-left. So that's a problem. That's a problem for the Labor side of politics, that you can't just put down to the last election, the misery of throwing a Prime Minister out in the first term, and then that god-awful campaign that they had and the leaks and the like. This is part of a pattern that's been in the it's been in the system since 1990. Now, when I look to the Liberal side and the Coalition side, something very interesting happens. They have a similar problem. It's not as pronounced as Labor's, but it still is a similar problem. We'll just look at the last two entries to government for the Coalition. Malcolm Fraser was 75, one with a primary vote of 54%. John Howard in 96, one with 46, but at his last win in 2004, 46.7%. Pretty good numbers, pretty strong numbers. Tony Abbott got 43.62% in 2010. And we know it was a terrific result because up until a couple of months out from that election, it looked like Labor were going to get returned comfortably. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the big thing that's changed between 2010 and 2004 on the Liberal side, and well, the Nationals to one side, but on the Liberal side, what's happening in the cities is that younger women and younger men, to a lesser extent, don't want to touch the Coalition. They haven't gone to the Labor Party. They've gone to the Greens. I'll take you back to Victoria, and this is the other thing that's quite interesting when we look at what Ted Bailey pulled off. A very good win, but something similar is happening in Victoria that happened in federal. Ted Bailey in 2010 has won with a primary vote of 44.78%. That's not strong. It's a good win, but it's not strong. Steve Brax achieved minority government in 99 with 45.75%. But now let's take it back a bit. 92, Kennett wins with 52%. 82, John Cain takes power with 50%. Again, the same pattern we see repeating at the federal level, at the state level. So whilst it's a terrific victory, it's come with a smaller base vote. Now, the problem with the smaller base vote is there are a lot more people who are either thinking of changing government again or are not interested in politics at all. They're going to be marking this new government just as harshly as the Rudd government got marked by the national population when the Rudd government didn't deliver. Now, one interesting thing about the base vote is that this trend to much lower primary vote I see in New South Wales. It seems to have started in New South Wales. It didn't start in Victoria. Certainly isn't an issue in Queensland, hasn't been an issue in Queensland, and it seemed to have started with Bob Carr. Bob Carr never won an election with better than 42%. So whatever's been happening in this state in the last 20 years, the detribalisation of politics, I think it started here. Now, as I said, I've got a particular pet theory about the election result that the Green vote is driven by none of the above sentiment, not by a positive embrace of Green values. Now, I've got some exit polling shown to me after the election of why people voted Green. It's split roughly 30-30-30 between those committed to Green values, the human rights agenda, you know, very radical agenda on the environment, the other 30% who just wanted to send a message to the Labor Party, and the final 30% did not care about politics. Now, the problem that both the main parties have coming out of that last federal election is that their voters are saying the same things about the people they voted for, Labor or Liberal, that Green voters, the people who have already made the jump, were saying about the reasons why they changed, why they voted Green for the first time. So this thing is there, and it's not easily fixed. Because one of the problems I see in current media environment and current public discourse is that it's very easy to stop a government from doing things. It's very easy to run the white noise of media and opposition interference. Now, I don't think journalists do this deliberately. I just think it's just, there's something in the air at the moment, and it's and we're all making very, very quick judgments. We want Julia Gillard to change the world tomorrow. No, she hesitated. Okay, I'm not going to look at her again. We wanted Kevin Rudd to show leadership. Well, he blinked. Okay, I'll never look at him again. We wanted Tony Abbott to give us a positive reason for voting for him. He didn't. Well, they may not look at him again. Now, this thing is part of the era we're living in. Now, my problem with politics is that politicians do recognise this problem, but they now are living day to day. They want to win the day. They want to win the media for that day. The difficulty with trying to win the media each day is none of these messages get out there. You don't problem solve, you don't progress long-term reforms by winning each day. You certainly don't do it the way Kevin Rudd did, which is to turn up every day and not care what question gets asked of you because you think your job is to turn up every day and answer every question that gets thrown at you. Has anyone noticed how diminished the Prime Minister's office has felt the last couple of years? This is not just life after John Howard. There were some questions that John Howard would never take, and no one in the electronic media would think to ask him. Kevin Rudd to my mind, because he's running a bit of a celebrity former prime ministership, put himself in a position where he became a sort of a pop culture commentator. Now, if it comes from genuine belief, say he's interested in rock and roll, or say he's interested in sport, as John Howard was with cricket, I'd probably accept that as a listener. But if you put yourself in a position when you go on FM radio or AM talkback radio, and pretty much every question that comes to you is demanding an answer of the Prime Minister, at what point can a Prime Minister talk to you as the Prime Minister when he's basically fielding questions from all over the place? Kevin Rudd looked good for a couple of years, but within the government, there was this concern that he kept turning up every day and wouldn't focus on the big decisions that he needed to take. And he wouldn't focus on where he wanted the government to be in 2010 going into an election year. Now, the great disaster for the Labor Party of the 2010 election year is not just them walking away of their convictions on the ETS. It's the fact that February this year, when they were looking at a double dissolution election and they blinked, there was all this unfinished business. There was the health and hospital deal with the states. There was the rollback of the home insulation program. There was a budget to land, and the budget had to show an earlier return to surplus. There was the mining tax debate. And there was also the mechanics of walking away from the ETS and working out what the position post-Copenhagen was going to be. These are six things on a government's plate in an election year. Normally in an election year, your decks are cleared by the end of the second year, and a government just focuses on a single re-election message with a goodie. Or there's a problem to solve, maybe they'll throw the... There were six things. There was a couple of other things that I didn't mention, like childcare and stuff. They were throwing that policy overboard. How did the government get itself into that position? Well, it lived with the 24-hour media cycle and thought just turning up every day would be enough. And it all caught up with them. Yeah, but I see this problem translating itself across pretty much every jurisdiction. Now, it's not my fault as a member of the media that I now have the tools that I didn't used to have before the internet to be able to shout a government down, because I think it is possible for media, without meaning to be able to shout a government down. I think part of the problem is that we've got a generation of politicians who think that that is their job. That is their job, to fill the hole every day. Now, I did have this conversation with Kevin Rudd a couple of years ago. His position was, if he didn't turn up every day, the media would eat him alive. They'd be demanding the Prime Minister come back. But if he'd taken a week off and come back with a much bigger idea, the microphones still would have been open for him. Now, Julia Gillard is trying to change the way the government handles its messaging, but I think the government is in so much trouble at the moment that her best intentions on running the government in a little more civilised way are probably not going to yield much fruit for her as a Prime Minister. Now, again, the problem applies in opposition, I suspect. What happens when you attain power? Let's assume Tony Abbott had achieved Plan A, which was essentially through a couple of placards, stop the boats, end the waste, threw a government off its game, and the government threw power away. Turns up the next day, he gets the incoming brief from the Treasury. We've got this once in a 100-year boom to deal with. We've got all these issues. At what point was the Abbott government going to change the public conversation to tell the people of Australia, oh, by the way, all that stuff we wanted to stop, there's going to be variations on the theme that we're now going to have to activate. Now, I don't think the terms on which the Liberals sought power at the last election was worthy of the nation any more than the terms on which Labor sought to hold power was worthy of the nation. Because both of them were arguing roughly the same story, which was you can get painless change, or that things could be put off, or that the slogan would probably get them through the day rather than having to explain a policy. Now, as I said, one of the central bits in the essay is that I think the reform era ended many years ago. I suspect the date is around early 2001, when John Howard threw away the fuel excise to bed down the GST finally. Between 2001 and 2010, we've seen a couple of big reforms attempted. Work choice has been the most obvious one, and for the Labor Party, mining tax and the ETS. Now, leave to one side your attitudes on any of those things, and just remember that in the 80s and 90s, a lot was achieved from both sides of politics. Now, why couldn't John Howard get work choices through? Why couldn't Kevin Rudd hold a conversation long enough to convince people to go the mining tax? Why did he walk away from the ETS? I think lobby groups have a lot more power than they did 10 years ago, and I think the media has a shorter attention span than it did 10 years ago. Now, when I look at that final term of John Howard's, what happened with work choices was, got the Senate, rammed it through, tried to change the conversation. In the next 2 years, the ACT played him off a break because he wasn't arguing work choices in the public space. Something similar happened to Kevin Rudd with the ETS. He stopped talking about it. Tony Abbott played him off the break with no, as the ACTU did with work choices with no. As I say, leave to one side your views on any of these policies. What we've seen in the final two terms of the Howard government and this first term of the Labor government, people we assumed were grown-ups, not been able to hold a public conversation for long enough to convince people that they can change things. And this has been a long time coming. I think the hung parliament has been a long time coming. But the problem I see now, which I'm a bit pessimistic about it for this coming term with minority government, the problem I see now is that no one has worked out a way yet how to think their way out of this problem they're in. We now know that it's very good, the internet, for campaigning, for opposition. Barack Obama found this in the US. He used new media to market his genius. As soon as he had the burdens of office, the Republicans said, we'll just use the same tool to stop him from doing stuff. And he couldn't hold a conversation long enough to get anything through. And he has obviously got his health reforms through, but now they're under challenge. Now, the US have got an unemployment rate of around 10% and their deepest recession in more than 50 years. Australia missed the GFC, yet Kevin Rudd ended up with roughly the same poll numbers that Barack Obama did. A couple of years into it, they went south. And at that point, you have to ask yourself whether it's a structural issue as opposed to cycle. And I think it's a structural issue. I think at the moment, people in power are surrounded. Whether they're surrounded by, you know, focused, disciplined oppositions, disinterested media, disengaged electorate. Now, you don't get their attention by deferring to them. You don't get the attention by saying to the opposition, well, you're right on the ETS, I'll walk away from that. You don't get the attention of the media by saying, I'm here, what do you want to know? You certainly don't get the attention of disengaged voters by asking through a focus group, what do you want us to do? And this has been the big problem, especially on the Labor side, both at federal and state level. Now, we haven't talked a lot about the New South Wales government here, but the less said about them, the better. But one of the big problems the Labor Party have found federal election and the state election was that they couldn't, for all the polling they did, they could not read the national mood. Tony Abbott had a pretty good fix on the national mood. They wanted to punish Labor. But Tony Abbott's story only resonated in terms of seats in Queensland and New South Wales, in Queensland and Western Australia, in the mining states. A couple of seats swung here, but Labor still hold the majority in the federal parliament in New South Wales, and Labor got a swing to them in Victoria. Very strange election. It's like the top half of the nation went one way, southern states went another way. In fact, at each crossing of the border from Queensland to Tasmania, you get a 5 percentage point increase in Labor's primary, in Labor's two-party vote at the last federal election. 45 in Queensland, 49 in New South Wales, 55 in Victoria, and then over the Bass Strait, 60 in Tasmania. So you're looking at a fairly polarised nation there. Now, neither side of politics could catch, I think, the thing that was there. And the thing that was there was there were some people that wanted to pay attention to this election and they wanted to be inspired. Neither party could do it. Now, having missed the opportunity to inspire them in 2010, it doesn't mean that in 2013 we're going to have another one of those elections, you know, that once in 20-year cycle where people are actually looking to be motivated. There may be some kitchen table concerns by 2013 emanating from the mining boom across all states that make it impossible for a government to stand, and that the opposition, when it takes its turn, a bit like the 70s, can't stand either. That's all I'll say for the moment. I want to throw open to some questions. It's a pretty tricky time we're in at the moment, and it's not something that you and I can do much about. At the end of the day, I think we need some grown-ups in the political sphere that can think their way out of this present impasse.
Many thanks, George. Janet Grundy's got some copies of Trivial Pursuit at $19.95 or the special Sydney Institute price of $20 if you don't have change. And we'll Anne will put it up on our website as well later on. And the talk goes up on the podcast, as I said, and it'll be published in due course. So we come to questions and discussion. I'm sure George would be happy to sign any papers. Can I just start off? You mentioned, very interesting, but if you look at political leaders, you mentioned Arthur Corwell, Gough Whitlam, Malcolm Fraser, Bob Hawke, Paul Keating, John Howard. What you didn't mention, of course, was Robert Menzies. And if you, I just wonder how important is the primary vote. Because if you go back to Menzies, you will find out that Menzies won elections in 55, 58, 61 and 63.
Was beaten on the primary vote by Labor.
With the primary vote of around 42%. And it seemed to work okay. I mean, if you asked anyone who was the most successful Australian politician in the 20th century, they'd say Menzies, but he managed to get most of his election results with about 42% of the primary vote. So does it matter? If you talk to the back of the room.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a good question, but it depends where your third party is. Now, the third party at the moment is to the left of the Labor Party. So for the coalition, the path to power with a low primary vote is not as obvious as it was in the 50s and 60s, when the coalition were a genuine coalition. They still are a genuine coalition, but a genuine coalition in terms of the community that they appeal to. Labor, I think it was the 54 election where they had a 50% primary? I can quickly look this up.
Yeah,
they actually lost a federal election with a 50% primary, which would be unheard of in our system today. Yep, 50%. In fact, the highest primary vote in Labor's history, and they didn't win.
But there were only two parties.
There were two parties then. And the DLP came straight after that. The DLP obviously were, yeah, I suppose a better way to answer this question, would you ever envisage Labor voters going to Green and then preferencing the Liberals ahead of Labor Party? I don't think that's the situation that the Liberal Party are in at the moment. The other thing is, I think the breakdown of the Liberal vote in the 50s and 60s had a much more even spread, demographically speaking. They had a lot of young families that wanted to vote for them. At the moment, as I said, especially for younger couples without children and for singles, the Liberal Party isn't even on their horizon. Now, bear in mind, one of the reasons why Labor are in a position to lose seats in the inner city, which are the youngest electorates by profile, by demographic profile, is that the Liberal Party are running third. Now, if the Liberal Party are running third, they're obviously not doing well in the youth belt. So, it's a good question, though, because it's a slightly different problem. As I said, Labor are 10 points down on where they used to be, so perhaps the problem is on the Labor side to begin with.
So we go Anne, then we go Robert, then we go Penny.
There is, though, George, a problem with this notion of the green vote, because it's very concentrated and young people grow up.
They do.
And the first thing that hits them when they do is the cost of living. And the cost of living, if you happen to suddenly buy a property, you have to pay your electricity bill yourself, and see your parents or college or university or whatever. They all become realities. And so I'm just wondering to what extent we're overestimating this green vote, because for all that I can see, it was never stronger in Melbourne at the time of this last state election, and yet they didn't win a print seat. They don't control the upper house.
That second question first. I'll answer it like a politician while I think of the answer to the first part of the question. I think the media are not really encouraging this thing. I think there's a lot of scrutiny of the party, and I think what you're actually getting is a rejection of media as well. Because if media analysis of the Greens as a political party was what the people thought, they wouldn't be pulling 10% primary across the country. This is why I go back to the voter as opposed to the party. I think the interesting thing about the vote is that it's persistent now. They've never gone back in a federal election. 7, 11 and a bit in Victoria. Well, this is the question we don't have an answer to yet. Well, no, except every other third party outbreak we've had has only lasted the one election.
Not the DLP.
No, the DLP was a civil war. That's a slightly.
Hang on, but we've got it.
Yeah, but it's true. But the DLP wasn't a none of the above vote. The DLP was Conservative Labor splitting off from the Labor Party until the Labor Party, and especially through Whitlam, grew up. These Greens are not necessarily going to come back to the Labor Party. They may go to the Liberal Party, or they may just disappear out of the system. because they're starting younger, and the DLP was not a young person's protest movement. The Democrats went from, I'm not going to check the figure, but I do know it off the top of my head, they went from around 11% to 3.5% between the 90 and the 93 federal election in the lower house. But the thing about that Democrat vote, as I said, a lot of it was driven by economics as opposed to a none-of-the-above sentiment. The Labor will be looking for a fourth term then, and remember Bob Hawke said, you can vote for them as long as you vote for me, with your second preference. That was the strategy. Next election, which was the last election, where both political parties took some serious reform proposals to the electorate, Hewson versus Keating, was the last time we had a combined primary vote close to 90% for the main parties. So I do understand that 15 to 20 is not a majority, but 15 to 20 is unusual in our system.
Robert. The informal vote is often characterised as a protest vote. And in looking at the green vote and long-term voting trends, how would you characterise it? Is that a myth? Is it simply an indication of voter incompetence? Yeah. Or has it been changing?
Yeah. No, the protest vote is almost a completely different story. The informal vote. Informal vote tends to rise the more non-English speakers you have. So in a lot of the inner west here, for example, the highest protest votes. You see, it's like Watson and the like have got really high... informal votes. Now, the other complication is in some states where there's optional preferential voting, you do get errors between the federal and state. So you get Queensland and New South Wales effect. So I think there's certainly a Queensland effect. Now, at the last federal election, Mark Latham thinks, you know, that there were only two swings at the last federal election noticeable. One was the informal vote and the other one was the green vote. This is on first vote. But I've never bought that argument, because, and I've looked at this a couple of times, each time I look at it and then you do distribution by voter type, you do tend to get a higher concentration in non-English speaking electorates. So that is just not being able to fill the form out or making a mistake. And the higher up you get the education ladder and the income ladder, the lower the informal vote. So if you'd think that it was a protest from election to election, you'd think it'd be consistent across the seats. It never is.
There's a question here and there.
After the Senate changes next year, and Labor, I presume, will get a lot more legislation through which favours the Greens, do you think the issues between the Libs and the Labor will then sharpen markedly?
It should.
Affect the next election?
It should. It should. If Julia Gillard's plan A is to actually deliver some changes, and one of the reasons why I think the population, including Liberal voters, I think were disappointed in Kevin Rudd, was we do elect Labor governments infrequently, but we do elect them at a national level to change things. That's why I characterise that last term as the worst first term of any Labor government in history. So she's looking to get some runs on the board next year. Now, interesting thing about the Senate is you've got a metropolitan majority in the Senate, and the lower house now is the thing that's got all the state and regional differences concentrated. So I don't think the founding fathers had quite imagined the lower house would end up this way, but this is where the real splits are, in the lower house, not in the upper house. She gets a couple of things up. Tony Abbott, or if there's a challenge, whoever's the Liberal leader, let's assume it's Tony Abbott, more likely than not will be Tony Abbott, can't go to the next election saying stop this, stop that, if something's gone through. He then has to physically promise to undo change. That's assuming the Labor do get some things through. It's always very difficult, and Kim Beazley found this in the late 90s. Remember, he contested two elections on the GST. One was to stop it happening, and then after it happened in 2001, he ran on rollback. He was going to take a couple of billion out of the base. It's a funny thing about our system. This is why I think leadership has just gone so far off track in the last few years. Once you do something, once you change something, the electorate does move on to another issue. Unless the change is so rotten that it hurts them at the kitchen table. So I think you should have a sharper contest, because, and I think Tony Abbott's made this point, they want to have a positive agenda at the next election. So that's really where the contest will be after Labor has sort of cleared the decks. If Labor have implementation problems in their rotten policies, I expect Tony Abbott to argue against them, but he'd still want to present an alternative.
George, given your views that people are looking for an alternative, the trends in Queensland, and the trend in rural Australia to move to the cities and so forth, is there an opportunity for the Nationals here, and are they getting it? Are they seeing that opportunity as that alternative?
Yeah. One of the great untold stories of the federal election is that the Liberal National Party brand won and won big.
Yeah.
The 9 seats were essentially LNP. The Liberal and National parties did not win many seats in the rest of the country. In fact, they went backwards in Victoria. Now, that's a merged entity that probably can't apply anywhere else in Australia because it's still Queensland's the most still the most decentralised state. The National Party wants to recontest the coast, in my mind, otherwise it will die as a political operation. Because as the demography moves not just to the cities but also to the coastline, you do get this rise in independence or Labor or Liberal contest. The seat of Richmond now is a safe Labor seat. Doug and Larry Anthony's seat is now a safe Labor seat. Would have been unheard of 2 elections ago. Blackjack McEwen's seat's a Liberal seat. Tim Fisher's seat's a Liberal seat. Mark Vale's seat, of course, decided the last election because he gave it up to Rob Oakeshott by moving mid-term. Look, the National Party are not necessarily a dying species. If they can get that country-mindedness and some coastal-mindedness going again, if they can start to stand alone again, otherwise the independents will probably end up running over them, and you'll have a local mayor in every second federal electorate. That's the difficulty with them. I think, you know, one of the sort of less commented on but interesting features of the last federal election is that the National Party, having been so close to the Howard government in power, had nothing to show for it coming back from opposition to go back into power. It was really all the action was on the Liberal side and the LNP in Queensland.
George, the take-home message I get is that if somebody was strong enough in one of these parties to stand up and offer a pragmatic governance and management of
problem solving,
of the
yes,
country,
yeah.
If I could use that phraseology, that some of those 10% in that 3 splits of the Greens,
yep,
may want to come back to the place.
Yep.
You get a sense of that, and wouldn't that ride over the top of anti the negative rhetoric that comes out from the Liberals, wouldn't the Liberals rise above that?
This goes to Anne's point. It's possible if one of the parties get their act together that the Greens won't be pulling 10% of the next federal election. My pessimism is about the quality of talent on both sides of politics. It's not about the strength of the Greens as an institution or the strength of the protest movement. The protest movement is noticeable. It's the fact that no one can do what you suggest. And it seems obvious, but the difficulty is, how do you get the authority of leadership back? In the national conversation, how does a prime minister or an opposition leader get to address the people as a grown-up when so much of what they do now has been diminished by the information age? So that's a huge difficulty.
Do you think that it's largely the media's responsibility to keep the conversation at the higher level rather than focusing on the Tribune?
Look, I hear that a lot, but you know what? I'll give you a very, very quick history of the mediums. When print was preeminent, the first challenge that print faced was television and the 6 o'clock news, which knocked out the afternoon newspapers. First thing that happened to print journalists once television came into being was we started to write with a little more colour, and we went from black and white to colour display. So that's how we met a television challenge. Talkback radio, which is old medium, but in the 90s, it certainly came into its own, and it was motivating a good portion of the electorate as well. Print journalists started to type as if they were shouting. Now, this thing's happening over a number of years. What happens is that every new entrant, every new challenge to traditional media, to established media, changes the voice of the established media. Now, the thing that the internet has done to everyone is made everyone feel like they have to cover every base and have to be always on and, you know, write an article for a paper or on a blog, pressure on me now to join Twitter and a few other things. I'm not sure where we can, because we don't have the time, but, and there's no collective consciousness in the media either, because, you know, the difference between Current Affair and The Australian for example, even if we were of a mind to do it, I think the information age that we're in would swamp us anyway. So if you had, if we put out a paper tomorrow, and the Australian is about the only, I would say, in a self-interested way, about the only masthead in Australia that still takes its public policy seriously, and it leads with that, and it's not going to get distracted as often as everyone else does about where Shane Warne's been in the last 24 hours. And we do a pretty good job of starting and promoting debate. Doesn't give you better government necessarily. As hard as we try, I'm not sure that it's our job in the end. As I say, I think it has to start at the top.
So we go 1, 2, and 3, and that's probably it. Very quick, 1, 2, and finish with Michael. Yeah.
Thank you, George. Looking at the international level, after the end of the Cold War, we've seen a phenomenon like that in Australia, many countries. Hmm. Look at the centre-right parties, centre-left parties that were the dominant features now seem to be much weaker. Now in Italy, Democrazia Cristiana imploded.
Yes.
Germany, centre-right, centre-left, they have always over 40%. Now they have 30%. And in Great Britain, in Britain now you have also a coalition government.
And they're all, the thing that worries all of them across the world is what happened in Canada. When a party went to 2 seats.
Do you think it's an international phenomenon?
Yes,
or
yes.
Why is there this disintegration of these parties that dominated the political landscape?
The end of the Cold War and a particular economic model, which both sides of politics, the end of the Cold War removed the sense of a black and white argument. And the economics and the merging of the main parties on economics meant that there was not that much new to fight for. So the differences between the parties almost had to be exaggerated to create this contest. And I think that that's the thing that turns some voters off. And I think that, as much as the Cold War, I think it's the way the main parties have reacted to the absence of clear difference. They're trying to create difference that has caused this other problem. Interesting, in all our systems in the UK, a tight old Labour government couldn't be beaten by a majority Conservative government. You've got gridlock in the US, you've got hung parliaments everywhere you look in Australia. It seems to be the trend now. And part of it does come back to the fact that neither main party can come into an election when the tide is when the wave is breaking their way, and to be able to carry a base plus extra because their base is diminished. And this is the problem, as I said, this is a problem for both sides of politics. And they can never carry a swinger with them because they don't have the 40 or 42 that they traditionally relied on to turn up for them every time, because in a funny way there's less at stake. But of course now we know for the last 20 years, if you put the pause button on reform, productivity falls, and productivity is a leading indicator of living standards. So around the corner is going to be a fall in living standards across the Western world because of what we're describing.
There's a question there. Yeah.
Do you think that climate change might be the elephant in the room?
In terms of living standards, or in terms of splitting the parties?
In terms of the alienation of Gen Y.
The interesting thing about climate change, and this is the interesting thing about Gen Y, is that the difficulty is with Gen X and the boomers especially, you can't take money off them, because we're all in the beyond the acquisition phase, we're trying to manage our debts, we're at that point in our lives. Gen Y is thinking about the future, so they are willing to make a sacrifice on behalf of the future. This is why they are so adamant on climate change. This is why they walked away from Kevin Rudd so dramatically. It's why John Howard, one of the reasons, and Arthur Sinodinos did make this point in a joint talk we gave after the 2007 election, that Kyoto was one of the big symbols, was second vote switcher after work choices. So it's there, it's certainly there, but it's a very difficult thing for the main parties to negotiate, because you can't go to Gen Y and say everything you ask for is very difficult to manage, because in the transition to whatever carbon abatement regime you go to, you can't throw your economy into a depression. You get good emissions reductions in a depression, you just get thrown out of government straight after.
Final question, Michael.
George, you've alluded to this in, I think, in the longest decade, and you seem to have, looking at it from a political economic perspective for the last 20 years, there's a couple of structural forces, and they're common across the Anglo-Saxon economies.
Yeah.
There's been a market in services, a global market in labour services, which wasn't imagined back in the early 90s. There's a movement from being income-based economy to asset-based.
Mm-hmm.
People feel rich, but that is now manifest, and you know, there's some dark side to that. And also, the leverage issue is on household balance sheets
rather than government.
These are big structural forces, and in reading through, you know, about, you know, we need more reform in that. One of the things that we're all kind of grappling with, those are big economic reforms, and no one's got any clue how to deal with them, because there's nothing. No looking back is going to give you any guidance.
No, you can't, yeah, and that's true. And in fact, you often imagine in our job, you know, well, we sit there and poke holes at all the poll-driven arguments that the leaders run. How would you confront the electorate with the next generation reform? And the next generation reform, especially for nation states, is to find a form of self-reliance that doesn't rely on traditional mechanisms of protection, whether it's tariff or other. So basically get your household sector into a position where when a GFC hits, it doesn't go under. Now, you can't do that if you don't get them back onto a savings footing, which is a sacrifice footing. Because you've got to get, you're right about the shift in the debt from the public to the private sphere, into the household sector in particular.
Which is sort of, if
there
was one lesson out of the 30s, it's not the place you'd put
households. It's the wrong place. I mean, basically, what you've done with risk is you've found a way where you transmit the first wobble in consumer confidence across the developed world, because everybody just says at the same time, well, I'm going to stop spending.
And your particular paper runs a sort of two-speed economy argument. So 50% of the Australian workforce is casual labour and enterprise workers or independent contractors. Where do you think the impact of this GFC has been?
Yeah.
That is the final question.
Yeah. It's true.
Part A.
Well, hang on. We're on the podcast. So just repeat. It's true. What is true?
It is true that a lot of the.
Who represents that group?
well, there's two things. If we're talking about contractors. No one represents them, and no government knows how many there are, really, even though they've done the numbers on them. They don't really know what to do for them, because when you get your wealth smashed like the GFC did and you're still employed, the government looks at the macro number and says unemployment is only 5. It hasn't even got to 6 yet. We're home. You know, we'll be talking about this for the next 20 years. Great escape. And then you look at super funds down 30% over that fiscal year. You look at a lot of people who are planning an early retirement, having to work an extra couple of years, but the sorts of jobs at the other end of the GFC were not the full-time jobs that they had before the GFC. You look at a lot of people working for themselves, didn't get their bills paid as quickly, but the debt is still there. You're right. The deregulated economy has, in a sense, it's thrown up a couple of big challenges that were never, as you say, in the manual. Because there are some, in a funny way, unintended consequences of deregulation. Like if you get to the point with financial innovation and with a sort of a de-tribalised society and workforce, with a lot of people working for themselves, a lot of people, you know, atomised in a sense, not belonging to trade unions, not having the one career path. Look, all that's great when the economy's booming and your asset values are rising, but it doesn't make for pretty downturns, even slowdowns.
George, many thanks.
Thank you. Just
I'll be very brief. I think this is George McLaughlin's third appearance at the Sydney Institute, and he's always thoughtful, and those of us who follow him on television or daily in the Australian notice this, and I guess that no one spends more time in Australian politics analysing statistical data from opinion surveys and drawing conclusions and suggesting hypotheses, and we've seen that again today. So
Thanks very much for an informative and thoughtful address. There are copies of Trivial Pursuit available today. Talks on the podcast, as I said, and will publish the paper in due course in the Sydney papers. But for tonight, well done, and I'm sure you'll be back again soon. It was just a question of when, but I'm sure before the next election. So for tonight, thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.